Okay, so it's a new week. It's there's a ton of new things happening in the markets, and I've got a lot more new things to talk about. And I'm going to start off with some, you know, rate hike. The Fed's talking about rate hikes. The Fed finally sort of realizes that there is inflation and that maybe it's not as transitory as they thought it was. Then I want to go a little bit into the reverse repo now that should be considered a very big type of news, I guess, with what the Fed is doing, because it's never done as much reverse repo as it has today. And so I think that is very important to take a look at, you know, the whole reverse repo market. And of course, you know, everyone's love or hate asset, you know, crypto, Bitcoin, it's been falling off. And so I want to talk a little bit about that too. And so I'm going to start off with the whole inflation scare, the whole rate hike scare that's been happening this week, probably the biggest news that's been happening. And so basically you have the Fed kind of admitting that you got inflation, and maybe it's not the most transitory inflation in the world. So maybe the inflation is going to last longer than once you reopen the economy. And so the Fed might hike rates, you know, as early as 2020 instead of 2023. Now, the rate hike is probably not that significant. I mean, you know, back in 2016, after the financial crisis of 2008, you know, the rate hike there from, I think it was 0.25%, it went to 0.5%. So although the interest rate doubled, it was, I mean, the magnitude is still completely insignificant. I mean, a quarter of a percent increase in interest rates. Now, when you're so levered up that that little amount, that little increase makes a big difference, well, then you should be very scared. But when that amount, you know, was just 0.25%, that really doesn't mean anything. And so even if the Fed increases rates as early as 2022, you know, you have to think about the magnitude that it's going to increase rates. And I don't think today, you know, the Fed or the whole U.S. economy can handle rates as high as they were in 2019, right before we started to completely just push down rates in 2020 after the crash, after, you know, COVID, and during March the stock market was tanking. And so, I mean, after that whole problem that happened, you know, after that, we're not going back to higher interest rates, right? Even if we go higher, it's not going to get as high as it was back, you know, after they started tapering after the 08 crisis. And so, you know, it's probably insignificant, the rate hike, but I mean, the market started falling off anyways for around 3 days, dropping 1 to 2% every day. You know, the Dow was the biggest dropper from rate hikes. Now, I don't know why the Dow dropped more than, you know, say the NASDAQ. Doesn't make too much sense. But, you know, in the short term, nothing really makes too much sense. The S&P was falling over 1% for around 3 days. And so you had all these major U.S. indices fall off in a week. But then, you know, after that, they climbed back up to where they were before that three-ish day fall off. And so, you know, today they're at their all-time highs or around there, and you don't have nearly as much worry in the markets. You know, the volatility is a lot lower in the markets right now. And so the markets are becoming peaceful again. But, you know, the rate hikes and the inflation that the Fed is seeing right now and the inflation that everybody's worried of right now shouldn't be what everyone's worried about. You know, that's not the scary part, right? That's, and, you know, the inflation we're getting today, I think it's mostly because of rising oil prices. You know, the U.S. oil prices, you know, if you look at the Western Texas, right now it's around $73 a barrel. If you look at Brent, which is the more so the internationally recognized oil, it's trading around $75. Now, the actual quality of the Western Texas is actually better than the Brent, but it's a little bit cheaper anyways. And no, I think that's mostly because of the difficulty of transporting the oil and, you know, the massive supply of oil in the U.S. And so main consumers are Americans. And so, you know, we have all this international supply chain issue, and that, I think, pushes down the price of higher quality oil. But anyways, I don't want to talk about oil in this episode. And I want to talk about the whole inflation and the whole rate hike scare that's going on right now. And really, that shouldn't be the most scary thing. The inflation we're getting today, a lot of people say it's because we're printing too much money, we're keeping interest rates too low. And yeah, that is one reason, but the main reason right now is just because we're also getting a commodity boom. We're also getting oil, the oil price is rising. And if we're getting rising oil prices and we're getting more and more of an oil shortage, well then, you know, of course the price of everyday goods and everything else is going to increase as well. But that's not because of necessarily a monetary inflation. That's not because we're printing money. That's not because we're the government spending too much money that was basically funded by the Fed or monetized by the Fed. But it's, you know, a lot more so because we're getting commodity prices rising. And, you know, you could say that we're getting rising commodity prices, you know, because the you know, because governments around the world are printing so much money. And yes, over the long term, that's definitely true. But at the same time, in the short term, you could also think of it as a cyclical increase in commodity prices, which happens all the time. And so it's kind of hard to tell which it is exactly, because you're seeing prices increase from producers first instead of just from the consumers. And so that's a much better indicator that you're getting, you know, raw material caused inflation. And so that's a problem, sure, but that's a much smaller problem than you would get if you had, you know, the government go out and spend, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars backed by the Fed. And now, you know, there's all this new money out in the economy. Or, you know, if you somehow adopt a negative interest rate system, or but I don't think the government can make banks lend at negative rates. That's just impossible. No bank would lend unless if, you know, you have the system where, you know, banks are now owned by the government and the government just wants to lend at negative rates. Well, that's possible. Or if we have some type of central bank digital currency, you know, I would suppose that would allow the Fed or whatever central bank to do the same thing. you know, it would allow the central banks to lend to individuals at 0% interest rate and negative interest rates. And if you get negative interest rates or 0%, well, yeah, you're going to get a ton of inflation. But at the same time, you know, Jerome Powell says, you know, he's not going to go for negative interest rates. He's not going to go for central bank digital currency. And I don't think there's really a need for negative interest rates, at least as of now. And a need means, you know, more so of a political need than an economic need. But there's no need politically or economically right now anyway. So right now, near term, the chances of those happening is not too high. And the inflation right now that we're getting is more so caused by, you know, the supply chain prices increasing, raw material prices increasing, rather than the price increase we get from just massively printing money. And usually when, you know, debts are very high and interest rates are very low, you have governments use some type of fashion to just massively increase the money supply. And that might be coming relatively soon, but right now what we're getting is not it. You know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, at the same time today, I think, or not too long ago, the Fed's balance sheet, which everyone loves to point at, just hit $8 trillion. Now, it's been sitting at over $7 trillion since 2020, the crash there. I think it doubled in the last recession a year ago. And it just sat at around over $7 trillion. It was slowly increasing. By slowly, I don't mean that it's insignificant. I mean, it's relatively slowly to how fast it has increased, you know, in the past. Not to say it's been increasing slowly, but it's relatively slowly. It just hit $8 trillion, and you know, they're still planning to do around $120 billion monthly of QE purchases, and it's around, you know, they want to make it around 80% treasuries and around, not 80%, I mean, sorry, 80 out of the $120 billion treasuries and around 40 of the $120 billion mortgage-backed securities. And so, you know, at that rate, every month you get $120 billion. Yeah, you're going to add up trillions, not too slowly. And so, you know, how long is that going to last? That's something you have to ask, because if you keep on doing this, well, then eventually the trillions start to pile up and you're going to need more and more trillions. 120 billion is going to go to 200 billion. You're just going to keep on expanding the balance sheet forever. And, you know, I think probably people back in 2008 thought that the Fed could increase its balance sheet and then pay everything back off and, you know, just decrease, or I guess sell everything, not pay it back off, but sell everything and have a zero or, you know, small balance sheet again. And it's just not able to do that. Because if it starts trying, well, interest rates start spiking, you know, the asset prices start collapsing and we have another recession and the Fed's back doing its old thing again. And, you know, the Fed's balance sheet is only getting longer, or it's only getting bigger in the long run. And it is in the short run right now anyway. So long run, short run, it's getting bigger in 2022 if they hike rates, or in 2023. You know, it's not like they're starting to do QT. It's not like they're starting to sell their assets anyways. It's just they're going to be buying less assets. Now, that doesn't mean that they're shrinking their balance sheet. No, they're just increasing their balance sheet at a lower rate. And it's not permanently at a lower rate. It's just, you know, for however long it would take until they start seeing markets react in a way that's, you know, unstable or too negative again. And given how many or how much new debt companies have taken up in 2020, that could be relatively quickly. And, you know, during every recession, and probably the history of recessions, companies with debt had to reduce the amount of debt they had in every single recession. Now, in this recession, the opposite happened. In 2020, probably the first time in the history of recessions, you know, companies actually increased their debts, you know, as a whole. And, you know, I'm not talking about individual companies, but as a whole, companies increased the amount of debt they had, and at a faster pace than they would normally do. And so you're just increasing debt over and over and over. And once you start to let rates rise too high, then, you know, everyone's going to be stuck paying back their debt, and no one's really going to be able to pay it back anyways. And so, you know, what the Fed's interest rates move in kind of, they move in cycles. And I'm talking about the Fed funds rate, and I'm not talking about, you know, treasuries or whatever. They move in cycles. So whenever you get some type of recession or turn down or a pullback, a big pullback in the market, the Fed will lower rates and then, you know, try to push them back up once the economy starts to heal, unemployment starts to rise. And I think the big point is unemployment. That's what they care the most about. And, you know, letting the rates fall would encourage more debt, more spending. And so, you know, unemployment would be easier to cure through lowering interest rates. And, you know, of course, that's not really sustainable, but in the short term, it's a great way to increase employment. And, you know, so there's this cyclical increase and decrease in interest rates that you get, which is led by recessions, basically. And so, you know, the problem with that is it's not a very, you know, when you have a cycle, when you have a interest rate cycle, you know, it doesn't stay on the same line. Over the long run, it starts to fall. So you have every period of high interest rates is lower than the last period of high interest rates. And most of the periods of high interest rates are shorter than the previous period of high interest rates. And so basically you're getting lower interest rates every cycle, and the high interest rates of each cycle is getting shorter. And so basically you're not allowing rates to go back to where they once were. And they're only getting lower and lower over the long term. And how long could you keep rates so low? Well, if rates start to rise, you maybe can't keep nominal rates low, but maybe you could keep real rates low as well. And so, you know, that's why you want to watch out and ask, okay, well, how long can rates be kept so low? And, you know, the Fed seems like it's reacting already. Maybe it could be as early as 2022. Now, that's just kind of speculation. No one has really said anything, but there's no certainties at all. But It's a possibility. I'd say it's a 50-50 maybe chance of that happening. I don't want to actually put a number on it, but it's either possible or not possible. And I think you have to prepare for any of the two outcomes. And so if you want to think of this next market cycle, and I'm talking about, you know, assets as a whole, really, not, you know, alternative assets, but, you know, mainly stocks, let's say a stock market cycle. You know, if you think of it as going from, if you think of 2020 as 2008, and you think of 2023, for example, as 2016, and I'll tell you why. So 2020, you had a crash. 2008, you had a crash. Other different crashes led by different things. Now, fundamentally, they were both, you know, high debt, relatively expensive asset prices, but, you know, they both had a market crash. And so let's put them in the same basket. So 2023, or maybe even 2022, actually, the Fed is increasing rates. Okay, well, in 2016, the Fed began to increase rates. Now, I don't think the next rate hike, the next cycle of raising interest rates will be as high or as long as it was back in 2016 to 2019, right? That lasted 3 years. I don't think it's going to last 3 years. Or, I mean, it could last 3 years if, you know, the interest rate hikes are so insignificant that, you know, it doesn't make any difference for the difficulty of the borrowers to pay back the money. So either it's not going to last, the high rates are not going to last as long, or they're not going to be as high. And so you could think of the next stock market cycle as a shorter cycle. You know, it's kind of similar to 2008 to 2020. If you're expecting a crash, it could be very similar to 2008 to 2020. Think of it as another 2008 to 2020 cycle, except it's a lot shorter. It's a lot more volatile. It's a lot more condensed than it was back then. And it's probably going to be a lot worse. And it's probably also going to be followed by more inflation, unless, if, you know, the Fed could, or you know, the governments can pull off another very, very difficult task. Unless if they could do that, and it's not only a technically difficult task, it's also a politically difficult task. For both, you know, central banks, governments. And so you could probably expect more inflation the next cycle. And I'm talking about monetary inflation instead of just, you know, rising like inflation from rising commodity prices or base material prices. But something else you have to take a look at, and I think it's very interesting, is the overnight reverse repo market that the Fed is offering right now. And so, you know, what's so special about the overnight reverse repo market? Well, the amount of overnight reverse repos that the Fed is doing right now is at an all-time high. It's never done so much reverse repo before. Okay, and so, you know, the Fed did a little bit in the past. It's done an incredibly tiny amount back in 2001. It's a very insignificant number. 2008, around that period, also a very small amount of the reverse repo. but you know, maybe a couple billion, maybe 1-2 billion-ish, which is, I mean, compare to the, if you want to compare that money to the GDP or the size of the reverse repo market, it's you know, it's just a rounding error. But 800 billion in reverse repos every day, the Fed today is doing that. You know, that is all time high. It's unseen before. And to put that in perspective, the you know, total daily average of reverse repos in 2020, you know, how much money was put into reverse repos every day was only around $928 billion. So the Fed is doing 800 billion, and in 2020 the average daily was 228 billion. So I mean, that's almost as big as the whole entire overnight reverse repo market. So the Fed is basically, you know, the biggest player in a whole market. And you know, why is it so inefficient, or why is it so, you know, messed up? Well, that's because, you know, the central bank, and yes, it's basically a central bank, is basically the biggest, you know, part of the whole reverse overnight reverse repo market. And you know, again, I've talked about reverse repo before, but I want to go back into this, and I want to talk about how the Fed is creating so much bad collateral in the repo market. And I think, you know, I've made another episode on this, but the reverse repo market, you know, why are the rates otherwise probably going to be going so high? You know, why does the Fed have to do so much overnight reverse repo? Well, probably because if they didn't do it, you know, there would be a big problem in the overnight reverse repo market, or the whole, you know, repo market. Because, okay, well, otherwise, why would the Fed be doing it? So, you know, why is there a problem in the repo market? You have to ask that. And I think the problem is, or at least could be, there's bad collateral there. And so if you have bad collateral in the repo market, well, then of course, repo market rates will likely soar like they did in 2019. And they got up to like 10%. And then you're going to have a crash, or at least a pullback like you did in 2019. And so I think the reason for that has a lot to do with the Fed, who's trying to solve the problem, but it's also creating the same problems that it's trying to solve. And so when the Fed does open market operations, or QE, and it's buying up U.S. treasuries, and it's buying up mortgage-backed securities, that sucks out collateral from the market. And, you know, it's not like the Treasury can issue $1 worth of Treasury and the Fed buys $1 worth of Treasury. You know, that wouldn't actually, you know, take out collateral. The amount of collateral in the market would stay the same. But the problem is, when you do that, you don't get to decrease interest rates. And that's the whole point of the Fed. The Fed wants to lower interest rates. And so you have this issue here where the Fed is buying more of these assets than is being issued. And then, okay, well, the prices, or the rates on, you know, treasuries, or the prices of mortgage-backed securities, you know, they begin to increase. And so rates fall and the prices of mortgage-backed securities increase. But the, you know, the problem here is that, okay, well, what collateral does the people in the repo market use? Mostly U.S. Treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. And so now the cash, there's a lot more cash. Interest rates are lower. People are borrowing money at lower rates. But the repo market now has a lot less good assets. They have a lot less good collateral to engage in repos with. So when you have this problem, well, then what a lot of people do, and I don't want to get too deep into this, but they do a thing called rehypothecation. Now, to kind of simplify it, it's kind of like, you know, I go to you and say, okay, so you let me say your car is mine and I'll pay you money. But if, and you know, that's, now your car is my collateral. You let me say your car is mine. And I get to use it as collateral to, you know, do a repo with or to borrow money with. And then what happens if I default on my repo or if I default on my loan? Do they take your car? No, they don't take your car. And so it's still your asset, but I'm paying you to have the right to say that asset is mine for a loan or a repo or whatever. And so it's basically this whole system of assets that you can't actually get if your, you know, counterparty defaults. And so this whole system is very dangerous because if somebody defaults, well, there's a chance, and there's a pretty good chance, it seems like, that you're going to get nothing. You're not going to get your money back. You're not even going to get an asset that was promised to you. You're just going to go home with a loss and nothing else. And so when you have this whole problem, and you know, the Feds in 2019, they were lowering short-term interest rates. They were doing some thing called not QE. And you know, I think the whole 2019 issue was caused by increased repo rates, and they were doing not QE, and they were buying more short-term U.S. Treasuries. They were buying up the good collateral from the repo market, and so that would lead to higher repo rates. But you know, they think that lower interest rates mean lower repo rates, and at least in 2020, it did happen. But now in 2021, it seems like something's not going right because doing $800 billion every day in reverse repo, and that's not a tiny number. And so that means that something is going wrong, and that maybe, you know, there's an issue where if they're buying too much collateral, well, then you're not going to have any collateral, and you just, and you know, everybody's kind of doing some sketchy things with their assets, and, you know, saying I owe this, but I don't actually own this. And, you know, everyone's lending with uncertainty of, you know, am I really going to get this collateral if they default, or am I, you know, really going to be able to get my money back? And so this whole thing, whether it's QE, whether it's the Fed increasing its balance sheet, whether it's government debt, whether it's, you know, the whole repo market, it's not sustainable. And you're seeing all of these happening in cycles, you know, but every time the fundamentals look worse and worse and worse and worse. Every cycle that happens, you know, interest rate cycle, the cycles where the Fed starts buying up assets, you could say the reverse, or you could say the repo market cycles. You know, every time you go through the next cycle every time. The problems get bigger and everything gets worse and worse and worse. And so it seems like today, you know, the cure for the disease is, you know, like putting more gasoline on fire and thinking that eventually the fires are going to disappear, or, you know, eventually everyone's going to die. So why not just die from fire? That's kind of an unfortunate look. But talking about everything going downhill, Bitcoin, which is the last thing I want to talk about, has really gone downhill. You know, I remember its peak was over 60K and everyone was tweeting about it every day. And I pretty much deleted Twitter because of Bitcoin. But, you know, there's too many Bitcoin people on Twitter. But now, at some point this week, it fell under 30K. Now it's around 33K, but it could be at a completely different price at the time you're listening to this, because it's way too volatile. And, you know, is it really correlated to gold? You know, is it digital gold? You know, you didn't see gold fall off, you know, half of its price in, you know, a couple of months. Is it invertedly correlated to the US dollar? No, I mean, the US dollar was far less volatile than Bitcoin. And I don't know the exact correlation of, you know, the US dollar and Bitcoin, but I mean, probably has very, very little or no correlation. And if you compare price of Bitcoin to the price of global currencies, it probably also has very little correlation as well. And so there's really no way you could prove that Bitcoin is a hedge against inflation. It's a store of value. There's no way you could do it, because it hasn't ever experienced a historical period where it stood the test against inflation. And it kind of has gone through not a complete period, but a semi-finished period of where you had all these, you know, hyped up things like, you know, GameStop. I think AMC is still kind of hyped up. All these Reddit stocks, and you know, there's far, and you know, Tesla, and there's a far greater correlation between these assets and Bitcoin than there is between, you know, inflation and gold and oil or the US dollar or currencies around the world. You know, it's almost all about the speculative assets. And to finish everything off, I think one of the biggest correlations, at least that I see with Bitcoin, is Dogecoin. Now, Dogecoin and Bitcoin have the same, pretty much, not the exact, I think Dogecoin's a little bit late, but, you know, Bitcoin rises, Bitcoin falls, Dogecoin rises, Dogecoin falls. And maybe that's because, you know, the Elon Musk hype is kind of dying down a little bit. I'm not exactly sure because I deleted Twitter, but that could be the reason. I mean, but the point is, Dogecoin is also one of those hyped up, crazy speculations. And now it's dying. And so with those correlations, at least near-term history, because you don't have any inflationary periods where Bitcoin was around. I mean, probably the most inflationary period was, you know, a month ago, and Bitcoin was still falling a month ago. But, you know, you don't have any real evidence that Bitcoin or Dogecoin is a hedge against anything, really, other than maybe boredom, that casinos are closed. So, you know, that's where I want to end this episode. And you know, I hope the Fed or the you know, governments and the central banks hopefully slow down what they're doing. Hopefully, you know, we'll get, I don't know if we should get rate hikes in 2022, because maybe then the markets will, I don't think they're going to crash in 2022, but, you know, it will be interesting in seeing how everybody and everything reacts. And I think, you know, the market's already going to price in rate hikes before that. And so what will be most interesting is seeing how long the markets and all these companies can sustain rising interest rates because of all of this newly added debt. And so whether or not we get another 1930s, whether or not we get another 1970s, it depends a lot on central banking at this point. It depends a lot on, you know, Congress. And so it would be very interesting seeing what happens next.